Thanks for joining in on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. David is a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist professor. Welcome back, David.
Thank you very much for having me back, Larry.
Jamie Knack is an Extension senior wildlife.
That sounds old, Larry.
You're not old, but you're up there. You've climbed the chain. Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist. And we're going to talk about what's going on in the world of wildlife. And we're also going to take a look at maybe gift ideas for the nature lovers in your life as we talk with them. And I hope you'll join in with your own wildlife question or photo. You could email us a question or photo at talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Or if you have a question you just want to call, give us a call. Love to have you. Number's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Jamie, the deer harvest for the gun season, the traditional 9-day deer gun season
yep.
is over. And we've got harvest data from the DNR.
Yeah, so the DNR issued a press release yesterday with the preliminary data from the 9-day gun deer season. And so what they like to look at is to report trends in license sales. And that was trending up slightly. We had a few more license sales than in 2023. So if we include, there's so many different combinations of licenses,
yeah.
but if we were to include all deer hunting privileges, so that includes the gun, archery, crossbow, privileges that come with a conservation patron's license or a sportsman's license, there were 791,023 licenses sold. That was up from about 788,000 the prior year. And that's a number that's really important.
So what's the population of the state? Is it 5 million?
5
no,
million.
It's like 6.1, I think.
Yeah.
6.2.
6, is it?
Yeah.
So 1
yeah.
in 7?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. 6 or 7?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So purchase licenses. So that is a good thing because we know that license sales have a lot to do with revenue that goes back into wildlife management and conservation for the state. So that's an important number that the state keeps track of. As far as the harvest totals were also up slightly. So if we look at statewide gun deer season, so this doesn't include archery, the gun deer season was up 5.2% statewide with antlerless harvest at 3.6 and antlerless harvest at 6.6%. So about 90,000 antlered deer were harvested and about just under 100,000 antlerless deer. And so that was just up a little bit from 2023.
Yeah, I was thinking about the archery and the crossbow. You know, I think that has had, I mean, this is just me thinking off the top of my head. It seems like that's had a big impact, at least among a lot of the people I know.
Yeah, and I don't have the data right in front of me, but if you look at the DNR's website, they've been doing some research to look at since crossbows have become more commonplace, what has that done for total deer harvest? And if I've looked at that data correctly, it still comes down to the individual hunter
sure.
is only going to harvest X yeah. number of deer. And so if they harvest a deer in the archery season, that may affect whether they harvest a deer in the gun deer season.
Yeah.
And then we can dive into the tool that's being used as well between crossbows and archery. So I think the overall total right now, including archery seasons, so both vertical bow and crossbow and gun seasons, is at 289,000 deer harvested.
Okay.
So it's a substantial amount of protein going into the
yeah,
system.
Almost 300.
Yeah, almost 300,000 deer.
For how many did we say? 900,000?
791,000.
Yeah.
So
yep.
800,
yep.
roughly
yeah.
300.
Licensed buyers.
Yeah. With 800,000 hunters.
Yes,
yeah.
And some seasons to go yet. We're in the middle
yeah.
of the 10-day muzzleloader season.
Yeah.
And there'll also be a statewide antlerless hunt and holiday hunts in some select farmland zones. So I encourage people to think about those additional opportunities and make sure to check the regulations to see what's in effect in your hunting area.
And there's still a lot of deer left.
And there's still plenty of deer out there.
Yeah. And you know what? It's not the only thing you can do when you're in the out-of-doors.
That's right.
There's a lot going on. You know, it gets colder, and you know, a lot of people retreat indoors, and some of them, you know, maybe wish they could be out and can't, but most of us can get back out there, and there are many opportunities to experience Wisconsin outdoors and wildlife in winter, aren't there?
There are quite often, and as a matter of fact, if you look at the hunting statistics over the last few decades, the number of people who are actually hunting is declining pretty precipitously. Mm-hmm. So the number of people who are actually participating in what we call non-consumptive outdoor recreation or wildlife recreation, where you're not actually harvesting an animal, that is the vast majority of the people. And for a long time, bird watching was the fastest growing wildlife recreational opportunity that across the United States. So there's a lot of things to do out there, whether you hunt or not. But yes, certainly get outside in the wintertime. And as a matter of fact, sometimes in the wintertime, although there's fewer animals on the landscape because quite a few of our bird species, about 85% of our bird species migrate out of the area for the winter. Quite a few mammals and all of our reptiles, amphibians are hibernating. But we still have quite a few animals on the landscape. And one of the benefits of being out in the winter is that there just aren't as many people outside in the winter. So you have a better opportunity sometimes of seeing things because there's not so many people scaring animals away and moving them around and things like that. So you have a lot of better opportunity to see things. But yeah, go out. Bird watching is awesome. You know, cross-country skiing or snowshoeing if we have snow down, just hiking. One of the wonderful things about winter is with that snow, you have a natural tracking medium, and so you can see tracks regularly and frequently in the snow that you can't normally see other times of the year, and that's a really fun way to see animals.
Yeah.
And it certainly increases your chances of seeing signs of animals and improves your skills as a naturalist, which is pretty cool.
We've had some questions about tracks in recent weeks, as a matter of fact. It's come up a few times, and we've had some photos sent in and so forth, and people can learn to identify these tracks. I think the DNR even offers some training.
DNR does have some participatory science programs. One is a carnivore tracking program where they will train you in tracking carnivores, and then you can help by running a route or a survey block and then reporting that data.
So you can become a certified volunteer tracker.
Yes. Yeah. The other thing I would say for somebody who's just interested in kind of getting started is there are a couple of resources. One is Mammal Tracks and Sign, and it's by Mark Elbrock, and it's Elbrock. Mm-hmm. And another would be one of the Peterson Field Guide Series, Animal Tracks. And just starting with a publication like that, where if you go out and you see a picture, knowing to take a dollar bill, which is 6 inches mm-hmm. long, or a quarter, you know, something that you have a reference for the size.
Or your hand, if you don't have anything.
Or bring a tape measure or a 6-inch ruler. I often will take a ruler and cut it in half and just carry 6 inches in the pocket, right? I lay it down and take...
You don't carry a dollar bill with you?
Well, yeah. Jamie's cheap.
Credit cards. but yeah, something that you can reference that size when you take the picture, and then you can study it, you can share it, do some research and try to figure out what that animal is. Also measuring things like gait and that kind of stuff.
And how they put the back foot, where the back foot is relative to the front foot. And also, it's a real fun thing to do, and especially if you have kids, it's really fun.
Yes.
It's like being a detective.
Mm-hmm. And there are like professional trainings as well, mm-hmm. or, you know, higher level trainings that you can pay for and go with a certified tracker and, you know, really learn. And they're phenomenal because they're not only telling you what species it is, but what it was doing, where it stopped and turned or moused around mm-hmm. for prey or something like that. So,
yeah, pretty cool. Rob sent us an email, and it is a very cool email. And I don't know if you can see that ermine there.
I don't know if we can blow up the picture, but it looks like there's a little animal sticking its head out.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
it looks weasel-like.
Yeah.
Is that, I don't have my glasses on, so I can't
see. Yeah, so there are a number of weasels, members of the weasel family. So even otters are in the weasel family. But we have three weasels. We have the least, the short-tailed weasel, and the long-tailed weasel, all of which turn white in the winter.
And that picture is white, of a white head.
Yep, of a white head. Looks like it's been, like it's currently hunting in a brush pile. So hard to say exactly what species that would be without being able to see the tail. And also males and females in the weasel family have sexual dimorphism. So the males will be larger than the females. Hmm. And so you can have some overlap then, depending on.
So for Rob here, who sent this email, if he saw the tail.
If it had a black tip on it, it would be a least weasel. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, and then that one's white. So then weasels are also referred to as ermine or stoat. Mm-hmm. And it depends on whether they're white in the winter, and then they'll turn brown in the summer to blend in. And then that also gets us into this idea about phenological mismatch. So with climate change, one of the issues about animals like weasels and snowshoe hare that turn white in the winter, if they're white, expecting to have snow on the ground, but we don't have as much snow on the ground because of climate change, they stand out against that kind of brownish or greenish background, and then all of a sudden they're much more susceptible to predation. So this idea about phenological mismatch has received quite a bit of research focus lately, and it's kind of a not cool for the animals, not cool we've got climate change going on, but it's a cool focus of study.
Could be leucistic, perhaps? Was somebody just emailing in or albino?
Probably not.
No, this is a natural occurrence that is seasonal.
Yep. And too small for a fisher.
Yeah, yes, for sure.
Yep.
By quite a bit. Yep. Well, you can join in too, by the way. Enough about my conversation here. How about you? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Our guests today, David Drake and Jamie Knack. Always great to have. They come by every other month on the first Wednesday of the month to talk wildlife. Here on WPR News, I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at the world of wildlife on the show today with David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the UW-Madison campus. Great to have them with us. Questions for them? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or give... or you could email us, I should say, to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Wanted to mention, I was thinking, you know, you mentioned just in passing cross-country skiing, and I was thinking about the evening I had. Oh, it's a long time back now, but it was a candlelight skiing, snowshoeing event at... Gosh, I can't even remember the state park now, but there are a bunch of those events. It was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, there are. And those candlelight hikes, sometimes they correspond with New Year's Day or like first of the year hikes type celebrations. And sometimes they adapt. So if there's no snow, they become a hike more than a snowshoeing. But yes, so there's also some programs, Learn to Pheasant Hunt events will be coming up. I was looking at the DNR maintains an events calendar. Some of you may be familiar with Travel Wisconsin has events calendars, too, that you can search. Those two sources would be excellent ways. I was searching just the DNR's event calendar for the month of December and January, and it was just pages of events, often at state parks. Could be scavenger hunts, a night hike, which would be really cool.
We have the winter solstice coming up.
Yes.
There's a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of stuff with the winter solstice.
Centered around that.
There was a winter tree ID workshop. So lots of different opportunities to get out and enjoy those state parks in what is often their slow or off season, but a beautiful season as
it
is.
Yeah, absolutely. I know there are events at Mirror Lake and at Wildcat Mountain.
Yep.
Haven Woods.
Yep.
Another one. So there's lots there. Bill in Barnes, Wisconsin has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, Larry. What a great show. I just want to endorse the idea of getting a professional tracker. We had a terrific time doing that. He had us all down on our hands and knees sniffing the urine to distinguish coyote from wolf. And, you know, to pay to have that privilege, you don't think is sane. But it was really a great day in the woods. And if I can put in a plug for nature centers, the Cable Natural History Museum in Cable and the Hunt Hill Nature Center in Sorona, you could get in touch with either of those, and I think they could put you in touch with a professional tracker that you might be able to engage for a day. Or they both have winter outing programs that may include one.
Yeah, I'm familiar with both of those locations. I've done a fair amount up at Hunt Hill, and that in itself is a beautiful setting. So, they offer lots of great programs. Whether you hire somebody or if you happen to know somebody who's a trapper and you're not necessarily mm-hmm. trapping, but their skills, their outdoor mm-hmm. skills, ability to read sign, you will learn a lot. So it's pretty fascinating.
Don't fall for the old tracker's joke about having them have you eat scat and yes. see if it tastes salty.
Right. Smelling's okay.
Tasting is not.
A whole different level.
Bill, that's a great call. Thank you so much. Appreciate it very much. Scott in Waupaca will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Scott.
Hi, guys. I was just curious about black bear. I know they hibernate in the winter, but I was curious as to whether or not they go into hibernation, and I know it's not a true hibernation, but I was curious if they go and do that based on temperature outside or if that's a daylight thing or what you guys could talk about that with.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
Sure. So it really has to do with day length. So, you know, we often maybe think that it's weather related as it gets colder or there's snow cover that they hibernate, but it really is triggered by day length or photo period. You're correct. They don't exactly fit the hibernation true definition. So they lower their metabolism rate. But in fact, sows will give birth during, you know, in the den over the winter. So it's not complete true hibernation in that manner. Also, on warm days, it's not uncommon if you're out in the woods to cut or to come across black bear tracks. They'll go out and wander around and then come back to the den. But they're certainly hunkered down. And I'd be remiss to not take this opportunity, but the Department of Natural mm-hmm. Resources is looking for citizens, people to report locations of bear dens. They're in the process of doing a multi-year study looking at reproductive rates or litter sizes, so how many cubs a sow has on average, and then looking at that in each of our six bear management zones to help better fine-tune population management for black bears. So
Yeah, I wonder how that turned out, because they were really making a push, the DNR, before the gun deer
yes.
season.
And that was a great, you know, with all the people in the woods, that would be a great time to find some. It would
be interesting to know how that all turned out. I think guys were, or gals, or mm-hmm. hunters were supposed to sort of locate somehow the area with their phones or something.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a survey that you can complete online on the website. If they don't want you to like peer in or, mm-hmm. you know, get too close, but if you can just, take a pin of the location mm-hmm. or take a photo and, have the den in the photo and submit that mm-hmm. along with directions and things like that, contact information, then they would follow up.
Yeah, and don't share that location widely because they don't want the den to get harassed or disturbed either,
No, for sure. Doug in Madison, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hi there. Yeah, you know, similarly along with the bear conversation, can you share the numbers of licenses and then the numbers of actual bears that were harvested in 2024. I remember hearing that number and realizing it was quite a high number. And I was kind of surprised, because down here in southern Wisconsin, we don't see as many bears as they have up north. But also, I just find that it's a very poor sport. You know, deer, I can understand. They can run, they can hide, all of this stuff. But the way that they're hunting bears, I find very unfair. I'll take your comments off the air.
Okay. Sure. Thanks for the question, Doug. And you're right, that report for the bear season harvest results did come out in the middle of November. And so I don't know if you remember us talking about it, but last year, last fall, it was a phenomenal acorn crop. And that can have an impact on, as well as many other factors, but can impact the number of bears that are harvested because those bears aren't necessarily coming into an artificial source of food. They have lots of natural foods. They don't necessarily need to, you know, to travel as far. And so we did see a dip in our bear harvest in 2023. This year, 4,285 bears were harvested during the five-week season, which was a rebound below the average harvest. Last year, it was about 3,000 bears. And so the current population estimate for bears in Wisconsin is about 23,000 bears. And so looking at this 2024 season, there were 11,500 licenses issued for those 4,285 bears that were harvested. So that gives you an idea of the what
one
we
in
have
three
a
roughly or
total population estimate, how many licenses, success rate was about 37% for those harvest. As far as the, you know, the ethics of bear hunting, as many of you know, I am a hunter. I enjoy a lot of things that go along with hunting and the wildlife ecology and the management and, you know, seeing animals when I'm out there, the time with family for all of those reasons. Bear hunting in Wisconsin is one of the top states in terms of our number of bears that are harvested. And we actually have a couple of legal methods that not all states have. And that is, one, we can use trailing hounds to trail and tree bears. And we also have the option of being able to place bait to bring those in. And bear, I would just say, are different in terms of their behavior, their ecology, than what you're going to have for white-tailed deer. And some of the swamps and thickets and huge public lands that we have in northern Wisconsin, it would be very hard to sit and simply wait for a bear to walk by. And so some of these methods are important to be able to reach those management goals that we have in Wisconsin, given the large population of bears. And that management is also helping to mitigate agricultural damage that we see, especially in the north. And so there's a number of things that the state tries to balance between habitat, human-wildlife conflicts, egg damage, and then the opportunity to harvest a bear, which is a lot of edible meat. You've got a nice hide, skulls, you know, lots of uses for the animal as well.
Debbie in Reedsburg, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Debbie.
Yeah, I had a question about squirrels. And I was wondering, it's supposed to get really, really windy, and I know they live in trees, but how do they sleep at night without getting blown out of the tree?
Yeah.
Well, they're what's considered an arboreal creature, so they are meant for the trees. They've got claws that allow them to easily move up and down trees. They're excellent climbers. They've got that great big bushy tail that helps them not only stay warm when it's cold out, but it also is a counterbalance. And so as they're moving across those tree limbs and things like that, that tail helps them maintain their balance. But they will either lay out on a log or, excuse me, on a limb, and they can perch themselves in such a way that they're not going to fall out. Sometimes you'll see them straddle that limb where they've got the limb between their front legs and the back legs, and that kind of helps them there. They're also cavity nesters, and so they will find holes or voids in trees and maybe sleep inside those cavities. They'll certainly den for the young inside those cavities. And when cavities are not available, they'll create leaf nests, what we call drays, so D-R-E-Y. And they will also sometimes sleep in those inside those leaf nests, and they've got multiple leaf nests within their territories or within their home range. And so they've got many different ways that they can sleep, not only to protect themselves when it's cold and windy, but also protect themselves from predation while they're sleeping.
There you go, Debbie. Thank you so much for calling. Open lines will get you on pretty quickly. Now, if you have a question or comment and maybe an experience to share relating to the outdoors and wildlife, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And if you've got a wildlife picture you want to send along, we'd love to see that too. Kathy emailed to say they observed a fairly deep hole. It was about 4 inches by 4 inches under their camper in the woods yesterday. There was frost around the hole, like, you know, like sort of like you'd see in a face mask. Any thoughts of what that hole, tunnel, whatever could be?
Huh.
That four inches.
Yeah, that's a little. It's a little big for a Norway rat, chipmunk, 13-line ground squirrel. It's a little small for a groundhog. Certainly small for a badger.
And many of those would be hibernating, so yeah, you wouldn't necessarily.
Yeah, wouldn't necessarily see that. I mean, it could be something, you know, like a. Depending on, I don't know if it looks active right now, but you know, it doesn't take much larger of a hole size that a red fox could actually fit into, and so it might be an entrance to a fox den, possibly. And then there's, you know, there are these underground burrows that have been created by a chipmunk, for example, that a skunk or other animals might excavate if that soil's organic and loose enough that they might excavate it and enlarge the diameter of the opening so they can actually get in there and use that den for shelter from the weather or predation or just to rest comfortably, perhaps to raise their own family.
Yeah, it was probably done, even though they just noticed the hole, it was probably done, could have been done last summer, maybe.
Yep.
And
But it sounds like they're seeing, like, condensation from the animal respirating is melting that area. So, another option then to try to figure out what it is, if we do get a snowfall, you can certainly look at those tracks, right? And then another option would be to place a trail camera on it and see what kind of critter you get. And then we'd be a little bit easier to help you if you wanted to address it.
For sure.
Brian in Madison, we'll have you on the air now. Let's go to you, Brian. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And I had a question about the raccoon and possibly muskrat populations increasing in the southwest corner of the state. I've heard anecdotally that a lot of the old timers that used to trap raccoon and muskrat are no longer around, and we've seen a decrease, or that's been pointed at as the cause for the decrease in the turkey population in the southwest corner of the state.
Yeah.
I'd love to separate fact from fiction, so thank you for taking my question.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, I'll start off, and Jamie, please chime in. Larry, you as well. So raccoons in particular are a very resilient species. They're adaptive, they're opportunistic, and quite often those populations, especially in areas where you have some human development, it might be a city, urban area, suburban area, something like that, the raccoon densities or the number of raccoons per area defined can get actually quite high. Same for muskrats. You know, muskrats are a aquatic rodent, and so as a rodent population, they are somewhat of a prolific breeder. And if you have habitat, including wetlands, cattail marshes, you've got sufficient food, things like that, those populations can also increase in size quite quickly and readily. In terms of the turkey population, muskrats are primarily an aquatic herbivore, so they eat primarily cattails and other aquatic-type vegetation. So they would not affect turkeys at all. Raccoons can certainly affect turkey populations because they will predate or go, if they can find the ground nests of turkeys, they'll certainly eat the eggs. If they can get a hold of the poults, they'll eat the poults. Once the turkey gets to an adult size, that adult turkey is a pretty formidable opponent for something like a raccoon. But the other issue with the turkey population in the southwestern part of the state is it could simply be habitat as well. And turkeys need open ground cover areas, forested areas. And if that ground cover, the understory of the forest, is starting to grow in to be pretty dense, turkeys will abandon that area. Or if you don't have sufficient roost trees, they'll abandon that area, or you may not have as many. So the turkey population in the southwestern part of the state, it might be an issue with predation of nests. It might be also a habitat-related issue. And, you know, we have a pretty sustainable and strong turkey population here in Wisconsin, but there are a number of states, especially in the southwestern part of the United, or southeastern part of the United States, in some of the lower Midwestern states like Missouri, where they're seeing the turkey population is declining, and it's been declining for years, and they're not quite certain what that is due to, but it's likely due to some habitat issue where either, the forest habitat or the turkey habitat is not sufficient, and or there's increased predation on the turkey populations in those areas.
Sort of a side note, I had a friend who's counted 52 birds.
Wow.
In his field the week before the hunting season and the start of the hunting season.
None.
There wasn't a one.
They're scattered. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Brian, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Cornell in Merrill, Wisconsin. We'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Well, yes, thanks, Larry, for the show. Yeah, I was wondering this summer, like I live north of Merrill by these tall pine trees, and it seemed like there was a lot of owls, and they were hooting back and forth, and they only start around midnight, and I was wondering what kind of owls are those?
You remember what the hoot was like?
It was a hoot, 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 hoot.
Okay.
And it was like... it was just a racket. I mean, it was beautiful to hear, but it only started, like, during the summer around midnight. And they're just, like, talking back and forth. And I don't know if that's a mating call or if they're just cackling. Or I was just wondering what kind of owl that was. I was almost going to get a flashlight, but I don't know if the neighbors would mind going around midnight shining lights.
Well, we'll try to help you a little bit here. Owls are some of the earliest nesting birds, and so they will actually, their courtship displays will start January, February, and that's when that's oftentimes when we have the phone call that you're calling about with their increased vocalizations during the courtship period. So then they raise their young. Their young are altricial, so they stay in the nest for a period of time. And then when they fledge, the adults are still feeding them. And you can hear a lot of vocalizations in the spring, late winter, spring, where the young are begging for food to be fed by the adults. So later in the summer, it's hard to say whether that was still a family unit that was vocalizing back and forth. And we don't really have an idea of size. We have a number of owls. Some of our more common larger owls that we typically associate with hooting are the barred owl, who does the who cooks for you, who cooks for you all. And also
they don't say that.
They don't say it.
That's
right.
What it sounds like.
That's what
like.
It sounds like. You want to?
Yeah.
And then great horned owls.
Maybe so, Jeff can find a barred owl.
Yeah, there you go.
Song.
I'm kind of suspecting great horned owl, but
I am too.
Yeah.
What I'm going to suggest is if you go to a website by Cornell Lab of Ornithology called All About Birds, and you type in great horned owl, it's basically a field guide online, but it'll include the song or the call for that owl. And so you can click on that and see if that sounded right.
But based on what he was saying, he said hoot, hoot, hoot. So it does sound like a great horned owl only because they really are a traditional hoot,
yes,
hooter, and they go hoot, 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 hoot. So
agree.
Yeah, so it could be that. That's maybe actually what you heard. Was
and another option then is if you hear that again and you take your smartphone, assuming you have one, and you've downloaded the Merlin Bird ID app, you can take that out there and you can record that song. And Merlin will translate it into what bird that is.
And so, Merlin would be pretty accurate on that
on
one.
On an owl, it would be.
On an owl, for
yep.
sure.
Yeah. Yep.
And that Merlin app is free. It's a free download. Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of sounds, I know I just wanted to mention it. At our last segment today, we've got Randy Beatty from the DNR on to talk about snowy owls.
Oh yeah.
Cool.
And I know Jeff's got a snowy owl song that we're going to be hearing
cool.
during
yeah.
that last segment of the show today.
Perfect.
So looking forward to that.
Yeah. And but yeah, just
well, let's
to,
do
just...
a barred owl. Here, yeah. Here's Jeff's got a barred owl for us. That doesn't sound like a barred owl.
So that's one of their calls.
Yeah.
It sounds like that's like a alarm.
Yeah, that's the alarm call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we didn't get the who
cooks for you.
Who cooks for you?
Yeah.
He might find it, but if he doesn't, that's fine too. We got the picture anyway.
And then just to clarify, the snowy owls are, they do come into Wisconsin, but in the wintertime. So we would not have snowy owls in the summer at the time that.
We'll be talking about that for sure.
Yeah.
Cornell, thank you so much for calling. Mark and Bowler will go to you. Hi, Mark.
Howdy. Hi, Jamie. One of your covert members.
Hi, Mark.
September, late August, early September, I had a wolf encounter on County D between Tillida and Bowler. I came around a second right-hand turn and here that deer is standing in the road. Nothing new about that, but it kept pawing at the side of the road, and it wouldn't run away. So I parked the truck, got out, and then the deer went into the brush on the opposite side of the road. And when I walked up to the fawn, I could immediately see it's not going to survive because its leg was broken. And at the same moment, a wolf burst right through the brush, not more than 2 or 3 feet away from me. And we were both surprised. he growled at me.
Oh,
I backed up. He lunged and grabbed the fawn and took off. And I'm sure he was responding to the fawn's cries, and that's what I heard as the wolf ran away.
Yeah.
So wow.
The fawn got recycled, and too bad for both it and the mother, but that was an interesting experience.
Yeah.
So did you, do you think the mother or the fawn, were they hit by a car, or it was a predation?
Hit by a car.
Yeah, I think you're right, though. The attention that fawn drew by the distress calls was a dinner bell for that wolf, unfortunately.
Yeah. Thankfully, he didn't figure you were the dinner.
A competitor, right?
Or a competitor.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's what that growl was for.
Right.
Yeah.
What a very interesting story. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. All right. Well, you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234. Or email to talk@WPR.org. If you phone, we'll get you on pretty quickly. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Looking at the world of wildlife today with David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. Great to have them with us. Join in 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Scott in Antigo. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Hey, I've got a question that this spring, it was early May, we've got behind our house about a 100 by 200 foot little woods that was full of buckthorn. So we ran some pigs out there, and we were trying to see if they would help clean that up. And anyways, the pig was about 125 pounds, and the next day the thing, they were out there about a month. And it was just missing. I mean, totally gone. No signs of no struggle anywhere. No path, like, because we've already had pigs get out, and they'll stay right with the other pigs. They don't go anywhere. And something took it. There were no human tracks. there were no, any other type of animal tracks or sign of a struggle.
What kind of fencing did you have?
Just a hot wire, an electric wire, probably 1 foot off the ground.
Hmm. And the pig was within that fence, fenced area?
Yes, it was within that fence.
With a bunch of other pigs.
With four other pigs. There were four pigs down there total. And then, I fed them down there for like a month. And then one day I come down there, there's only three. And
okay,
it's interesting though. I mean, there's certainly things that could probably ford that fence or get through the fence. But I think if that pig got killed, you would see a sign, a blood sign or blood trail or something like that. And that's what's interesting to me is that I'm wondering if the pig somehow didn't get out on
and then
its own,
couldn't get back
and
in,
and then couldn't get back in, or maybe an animal got in there and chased. Harassed the pigs, and one of the pigs got out just trying to get away from whichever animal got in there, and then couldn't get back in and wandered off.
Yeah, I don't know what it would be either. If you, I don't know if you spent time looking around the outside of the fence with the idea that maybe it did get across the fence or was chased and moved across. Just another option for you too, folks that, you know, deal with these types of livestock losses, investigate them, is to at least talk with folks from the USDA Wildlife Services in their Rhinelander office. They would be the ones, and I don't want to jump to, you know, conclusions here. We don't know. Coyote, bobcat, could be wolf, could have just gotten out on its own. But those folks investigate missing calves, you know, killed ant carcasses, you know, things like that, that they may have some additional ideas for you too, or even preventatively how best to enclose those hogs to prevent further loss. So.
Yeah. Do you go out there every day, or how often do you check on the pigs?
Yeah, twice a day usually.
Okay, yeah.
Usually morning and evening.
Oh,
and,
interesting.
And we walked around there for 3 days. And the only thing is, I have a bear hunter friend, and he said he's already seen a bear, like, he'll grab a cat, a deer or a fawn or something, and they'll just take off running with it. Now, this pig's 125 pounds, so I don't know that they could do that, because they would put up a fight.
Yeah, for sure.
Well,
but they can drag deer, and, you know.
But you'd think you'd see some sign. I mean, if a bear clawed a pig and pulled it up over the fence, you probably should see some sign of a struggle, or maybe a damage of the fence or something like that. But I don't know. As Jamie was talking about earlier, when we had the caller who had the hole in the ground underneath their camper, if you have a trail camera, a wildlife camera, maybe put it out and just see what animals are around there, and that might help at least start to narrow your focus on what the potential culprit could be.
I think that's a good idea. Scott, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Karen in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Oh, I have an unhappy question. And that is, I've noticed that there's an overpopulation of humans, and which are just mammals anyway. But I'm wondering how much land would per person need to have a subsistence living, and then if you move it up to comfortable, as in France, and then what part is done for transportation, and what amount of land in southwestern Wisconsin do humans live on? Because we keep talking about overpopulation of animals, but we don't talk about overpopulation of humans. And it's not that I don't want anyone's baby to be born, but I just think we can't keep consuming. And we're not consumers, we're human beings, we're mammals. Unfortunately, we have a very intelligent brain. Probably not the most on the planet, but in any case, if you tell me how much acreage and so on we would need for, and it's probably a whole nother show.
Yeah, it's probably, but you're right about that, Karen.
Well, when you were talking, Karen, I was doing the math in my head, and the magic number is 4. So I don't know. Honestly, that is a question beyond the purview of this show, and obviously we're getting into issues about societal benefits and costs and balance between different species and things like that. And then it also gets into, you know, population growth, population control, both for humans and animals. And that is a topic that I think is well beyond this show, and probably it also gets very, very controversial very quickly.
Yeah. All right. There we go. Something we can consider for another show, though.
Yeah, it's certainly a very interesting topic. And
I don't have any kind of data on that at all.
Or even who is, you know, working or doing research in that realm.
Yeah, but I think it also depends on if you look at, if we do want to talk about this, if you look at where people are concentrating. I mean, 85% of the United States population lives in an urbanized landscape. 50% of the world's population lives in an urbanized landscape right now, and 70% of the world's population will be in an urban landscape by 2050. So you have disproportionate concentrations of human beings in a relatively small footprint on the land. And I think, depending on which study you want to look at, the actual footprint of the urban footprint in the United States is 5 to 10% of the entire land mass. So if you spread out how much land mass we have across the United States and divide that by, you know, I think the population in the United States is 332 million right now, that will at least give you a sense about how much land per person there is in the United States. But again, it's a disproportionate concentration of people across the landscape.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you. Karen, thanks for calling. Let's turn to grouse and wolves. Dan and Marinette, your turn.
Yes, ruffed grouse in Marinette County. I've seen a lot of them this year, and not saying that I put any down. No. But anyways, is the population up?
I'm trying to think of what the cycle is now.
Yeah, it's usually years that end in 0, 9. So the population is in a kind of rebuilding phase of that 10-year cycle. So, but we always are really careful to talk about rough grouse and their population cycles, that even in low cycle years, or, you know, where populations are predicted to be low, habitat can win things over. Mm-hmm. So quality habitat, managing for rough grouse. You can still be happy to have rough grouse on your property, or to find them if you're pursuing them on public lands or private lands for hunting purposes. So,
Dan, thanks. Did you have a question about wolves?
Yeah. So you hear all kinds of numbers, and you talk to folks about when you're up in the woods there and you've run into someone, a deer hunter, you know, it's competition between, you know, wildlife, predators, and man. So approximately how many white-tailed deer does a wolf consume per year, individual wolf or pack?
I think we've got some data on that.
We do. The numbers that I have, you know, just off the top of my head that I can recall, are that average was about 17 to 19 deer per year per wolf.
How many wolves?
Well,
I don't know. It depends on what time of the year you're talking about.
It does depend, and we've gone to, the state has moved away from a minimum track count and to an occupancy model for wolf population estimates. And again, it does depend on what time of year we're talking, but over 1,000, but there's a lot of
variables go into that number. Yeah. Probably the best thing is go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website and just type into their search engine wolf, and they'll have information about population estimates there for you as well.
All of their wildlife reports that the state does will show up on, so for all of the species we've been talking about, that have wildlife surveys, you can look right at that data and see what the trend is showing from year to year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if it was 1,000 and they take 17 a year, that's 17,000 deer.
Yeah.
Which
is, in the grand scheme of things, I don't know how many are killed by cars.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
No, so it's not that high. It's 30 to 40,000. Yeah.
Is that
in
all
the state
that's killed? Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's some reporting.
Cars kill more than
the
wolves do.
Okay. Sure. And wolves don't eat only deer. That's the other thing. You know, they eat other things too, like beaver, and so they're not just.
It's a very slippery road, though, because when you start talking about wolves, they are distributed in the northern and central forests.
Yeah.
And we're talking about car kill data that's statewide, and deer population statewide. Yeah. So there's a lot of things to put into context when we start making those.
And obviously the deer population is more abundant in the south than it is in the north.
Which wasn't always the case, right? Yep.
On a happy note, Diane called in to say that Sunday, this coming Sunday, at Copper Falls State Park is a conifer crafting workshop and a hike. And, you know, Copper Falls State Park up by Mellon, I've been there many a time. It's just but I've never been there in the winter.
Mm. Oh, I bet you it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
I bet it's gorgeous. Diane, thanks a lot for this. This Sunday at Copper Falls State Park. Our guests today, David Drake and Jamie Knack, will be with us right up till 12:30 today, and I hope you'll join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. We'll take a break for a look at the news, and then we will be back with Jamie and David. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, looking at the world of wildlife with David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist, and Professor Jamie Nack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both affiliated with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the UW-Madison campus, and of course, Extension. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@wpr.org. Earlier, we were talking about barred owls, B-A-R-R-E-D, as opposed to barn, barred owls. And the call that they make, and I think Jeff's got one for us. Before we do anything else, let's hear the barred owl. That's the Who Cooks for You. We got it. All right, so we heard the barred owl's call. Rita and Bloomer, now it's your turn. Hi, Rita.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question that follows up on an earlier question regarding wolf predation on the white deer or white-tailed deer population. And I'd like you to compare, if you could, wolf predation on the deer population versus black bear predation on the deer population, both in terms of how it may differ across different areas of the state and the black bear population relative to the wolf population.
Well, I'll start, and Jamie, please chime in. So there's more, a lot more black bear in the state than there are wolves. Wolves and bears both are concentrated to the northern part of the state, so in the central forest region around Black River Falls, and then up in the northern third of the state where we have primarily forested landscape up there. Wolves will very occasionally, very rarely, come down into the southern part of the state, but black bears, again, not a lot of black bears, but black bears are more common to come into the southern part of the United States in individual numbers, not in great numbers. So you do have the potential for black bear depredation on deer in a greater part of the state than you do through wolves. You've got more black bears in addition. And, you know, both of these animals will predate deer, adult deer, as well as young. But there was a deer study done here in Iowa County a number of years ago. It was a five-year deer study looking at predation on white-tailed deer. And if you want to, I don't recall the exact numbers, but they did find that black bears were a pretty notable source of predation or source of mortality on white-tailed deer. But if you want to go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website and type in deer predation study Iowa County, you should be able to find the results for that. And I believe that a lot of the information is published from that deer study, but they were looking at predation from coyotes, bobcats, and black bears. And again, there was relatively notable predation by black bears from that study, as well as another study that was done up in the northeastern part of Wisconsin. So take a look at those numbers. I don't recall the numbers exactly, but obviously black bears are a predator of deer.
Yeah, and there's four times as many black bears as there are wolves.
Yeah, probably more than four times as many. Yeah. So yeah.
I think the study that David's referring to that was done in the Southwest, but also was done prior to the Southwest. It was done in the northern part. Really looked at predation or survival of white-tailed deer, radio-collared animals, and looked at their causes of death. And it categorized percentages by bobcat and bear and wolves and so on. So that would probably be the most applicable study to reference back to. I would just say with black bears, it's my understanding that their impact on white-tailed deer tends to be strongest when the fawns are born. And so they can run down a fawn. I don't know that they take a lot of adult white-tailed deer, so there's some seasonality with the amount of time they're on the landscape and taking fawns.
Yeah, and I guess the other component to that is, you know, wolves really are almost true carnivores. I mean, they will eat some plant material, but bears are much more of an omnivore. And so bears, they may not focus on deer like a wolf would, for example, because they've got so much of a larger palate available to them to eat.
Yeah. And wolves will switch in the winter to beaver.
Yeah.
They'll wait on the shorelines for hours at a time, waiting for an opportunity to take a beaver.
There we go. David in Oregon, Wisconsin. We'll go to you. Hi, David.
Hi. So recently on the Oregon Facebook page, someone reported seeing a bobcat. I just don't know anything about wild cats in Wisconsin and how rare they might be.
I can take that. So bobcats, if we were to put a number, we've been throwing around a lot of numbers, which is always... But so I'm just going to put this into, roundabout number here, but about 4,500, 5,000-ish bobcats in the state from the last survey data that I've seen. They're primarily in the northern and central part of the state, but we have documented bobcat moving through, even having litters in the southern part of the state as well. So not uncommon. I live in Columbia County. I get neighbors and landowners who share pictures with me, and we certainly have documented bobcats. So not surprised. They radio collared. I don't know how many were actually collared.
Remember.
The goal was around 30 for the Southwestern study. So certainly they're around the state. They're very secretive in nature, which makes them a rare sighting, but again, pretty widely distributed and a healthy, robust population, but a cool animal to come across.
And we've had bobcats come through Madison. We don't have any, it doesn't appear that we have any that are sustained here or that have, you know, they live here in Madison, but we've had them come through and maybe stay for a week or two in certain areas across the city. So it's not uncommon, but bobcats also are very urban adaptive species. If you look at Los Angeles or Houston or Phoenix, Atlanta, there's bobcats that live within the city limits of those cities and can do quite well within urban landscapes.
We had Virginia had called but couldn't stay with us. This past spring saw some baby turtles look like eggs laid in a culvert. Do they stay buried all winter? Eggs, that is.
Yeah, it depends on the species. So sometimes they'll lay eggs in the spring, and then they'll hatch out sometime over the summer. But they do, if I recall this correctly, Jamie, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there are some species that will lay eggs late summer, early fall, and then they'll overwinter, and then they'll hatch out the following spring, summer.
Yeah, they'll have glycol in their system, and it's like antifreeze, and they can actually stay in the nest, and then you'll have them overwinter and hatch in the spring.
Yeah.
Mary in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Two-part question. I was wondering, I heard that a chipmunk would be hibernating in September, and I was wondering whether that was triggered by daylight or temperature, and the same way with a black bear in Wisconsin.
So
as Jamie mentioned earlier in the show, both chipmunks and black bears are hibernators. They're not true hibernators. They are kind of in a torpor state where their metabolism is reduced. But we refer to chipmunks as kind of restive hibernators, where they'll wake up every 2 to 3 weeks, go to the bathroom, eat, go back to sleep. It's not the worst way to spend the winter, in my opinion. But all of that, so this is true for birds that migrate or animals that migrate. This is true for animals that hibernate. The large trigger for all of that is day length. And so as the days get shorter, as we approach winter solstice, that triggers these animals to say, well, if I'm going to hibernate, it's time for me to go to bed. And in preparation for that, you know, a month or so ahead, they'll start gorging on food so they can build up that fat layer to survive through the hibernation that they draw energy from. Or if you're a migratory bird, you know, they start saying, well, it's time for me to start flying south or, you know, some of our migratory bats. And then obviously as day length shortens in the fall, then we have other things that are associated with that. So the temperatures start getting colder, our weather patterns change, we have a different type of precipitation, and all of those are also refined signals to the animals that's either time to, you know, hightail it out of here if you're flying south or start, you know, preparing your bed and starting to sleep through the winter.
Mary, there you go. Thank you for calling. Jerry and Kakana will go to you. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, I have a question about rough grouse. There's actually a couple that link in there. A couple years ago, they shortened the season. It used to go to the end of January, and they were worried about West Nile. I'm wondering how that is affecting grouse now. You had mentioned that 9 and 0 were the peaks, so you have to build up from there. We should still be in a building period, I would think. And third question or comment is, a rough grouse life is very short. I think 50% make it past 1 year, and maybe 30% make it to year two. So why is our season shorter when there are not that many harvested by humans?
Well, you want
I'll start. So the West Nile virus, if thinking back to that research, mm-hmm. That concern was started in Pennsylvania, where they were seeing grouse with West Nile virus being reported. There was concern over whether that had an impact on our population. And I know that the blood samples, and I think they took feather samples, mm-hmm. Hunters submitted that data. We could see evidence that they had, some of those birds had infection and were able to survive. And I think it's just largely not become a major issue. So they feel that, again, with quality habitat, birds can handle some of that disease pressure. But overall, that they're not dying from West Nile virus, that if they do get it, they're able to survive it or rebound from it. Not to say that in a poor condition, they might be more susceptible to predation. But again, I think the bottom line is quality habitat. Populations can handle some disease and predation and so on. The peak, again, that's just a general trend. We tend to see the highest rough grouse populations, and that's coming from spring drumming counts and oftentimes flush count surveys that hunters are reporting in the fall. We see the highest numbers, typically 0 and 9. And of course, you're correct. We are in what would be presumably kind of a building stage again. So, and then the last question was about
short lifespan.
Yeah. Well, so there is large turnover or high mortality in a lot of game birds. Mm-hmm. And that gets into a conversation of compensatory and additive mortality. In this case, we're talking hunting being compensatory, not additive. So these birds are going to die, or a certain percentage of the rough grouse are going to die. By hunting some of them, you're not increasing the number of birds in terms of additive mortality on that population. So they can withstand some hunting pressure. The season structure and getting into some of that discussion is a little bit, I'm just a little out of the, a little mm-hmm. out of my expertise or how that discussion has gone. The other thing to think about is the number of rough grouse hunters who are interested in pursuing the birds, what our bag limits look like, what that can all have an influence to your season structure and so on.
Yeah, but we should say, and you're right, there's a lot that goes into structuring that season, but all of it is determined by making sure it's a sustainable yield or a sustainable right. harvest, and they want to make sure, regardless of what species is being harvested, that you're not dipping into the principle, so to speak. So yeah. If they're adjusting seasons, it's because they see something in the data likely that is indicating that perhaps the population is, if in order to sustain a responsible ethical scientifically determined yield, that maybe you need to adjust the season in some capacity to be able to maintain that sustainability.
And Jerry, we could get a better, like, specific answer to that decision from either the rough grouse biologist who'd be in tune mm-hmm. with it, but also mm-hmm. from the Department of Natural Resources upland yeah. game bird specialist.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you so much. Jeff in Wood County will give you a chance. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning to everyone. Hey, I saw an unusual buck 3 months ago, probably, when they were just starting into their horns. And the left horn on this buck it was like a drop pine, let's say, but its whole horn was laying over on its side, on the side of its head, and it was hard. And I'd seen it for about a month, and it would have been an eight-pointer. Okay, so the thing is, there was another buck with the horn like that on the opposite side of the head, so I know it was two different bucks, in the same year, and I've never seen that before. And I wonder, what the heck kind of horn disease that is?
Okay.
So most likely that was an injury in both cases to the antlers during the velvet or the growth stage. So injured the pedestal, the base of that antler, that impacted the shape, the function. So whether that was sparring or, you know, in some cases they might get hit by a car and it creates a really unusual configuration of the antlers. But I would say some sort of injury early in the growth season.
Yep, and the next year that same animal could come back with normal antlers.
Yeah.
Jim in Appleton emailed to ask if there's a way for non-hunters and non-anglers to influence DNR policies for such things as bear hunt, wolf management, beaver removal. The state has many more non-hunters, and it is collectively all of our natural resources, so how do we participate in influencing DNR policy?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're one of, I think, the only state that have a very robust public input opportunity in April of every year. I believe it's the first Monday in April, called the Conservation Congress Spring Hearings. And that's an opportunity for any person in the state to weigh in on proposed rule changes, legislative changes. It's a time to bring up discussions. I can think about in the past about, you know, should we have a mourning dove season?
Mm-hmm.
How should we
crane.
Address feral cats? The number of fish that, you know, the bag limit for walleye on X chain or so on. And it's an opportunity to weigh in and see if there's public support for that. And it's done at the county level.
So wherever you are, whatever county you're in, you can go, and if you want to take your friends and family members along, you can do that too, and everybody can participate.
And, well, and the agency in their role as a, it's their, you know, their role to help oversee the public resource for the greater good. They also are subject to public input processes to have times for open comment. So when we had our beaver management plan, for example, or our wolf management plan, there's a required X number of days for soliciting public comment.
And of course, you can work through your local state representatives as well, and other avenues like that.
Ethan emailed to ask why the deer population has been decreasing over the past few years and why there is, why was it more in the past compared to now? What factors led to the decline? Well,
so, you know, in the past, the state would use an SAK model, so sex, age, kill model, and would often, prior to the hunt, present a number. This is how many deer are in Wisconsin prior to the hunting season. And the state's really gone away from managing deer in that way. And so now we have deer advisory councils by county, and each county has representatives on that council or that advisory committee, and they look at making decisions based on the number of killed deer, the amount of agricultural damage, what does forest regeneration look like, what does hunter satisfaction look like, all of these metrics. And then asking a question, do we want to increase, decrease, or maintain stable the deer population in our county? And so we've been looking at it more as a habitat, at a habitat level, weighing in views from a number of stakeholders, and it's no easy task for sure. And as a result, the state's really gone away from kind of putting out a number. Mm-hmm. And throughout this whole show, you know, it's been a little it's dicey to throw out, well, there's this number of black bears or this many a bobcat. I say it in terms of like a real generality. There's not 1 million, there's 100,000 or something like that to give you an idea. But we don't have an exact count of the number of deer. And so I think a better question then would be to look at harvest trends in the county that you're interested in, which again is readily available on the DNR's website. So if there's a county you're interested in, I would take it down to that level and look at what does the data show for the past 10 years. Is the deer population increasing, decreasing, remaining stable?
Yeah, and harvest trends can be a little misleading as well because it depends on how many people are out hunting and, right. and
weather.
Weather and whether, yeah. you know, whether you actually harvested a deer and things like that. But I would also look at some of the other things Jamie talked about is the agricultural damage in your county increasing, decreasing, or remaining stable? Because that will have an impact. Number of deer vehicle collisions. So look at some of these proxy factors or proxy variables that also might round out the contextual description or the contextual story about the number of deer that might be in your county.
Yeah.
And I was just saying one last thing. I wouldn't just look at any one single year either. I'd look at it maybe over 5 or 10 years. So you're looking at a trend, trend data there.
Kimberly in DeForest emailed to say her spouse observed several deer recently. They all looked like white-tailed deer, with the exception they all had white socks. Sort of, they, you know, and wondering if it's an albino. Well, it's not an albino.
Yeah, no, it wouldn't be an albino. An albino would be all white with a pink nose and pink eyes. The other variation there would be a piebald deer, which would be white but without the pink eyes and pink nose. But it's likely it's just something mutated in some of the genetics of this deer within that local area is likely what happened. And we see this with other animals like squirrels. Sometimes you'll see a horde of black squirrels within a local area where maybe the genetics have changed a little bit. So instead of a gray coat, you see a black coat. And I suspect that's what's happening with the deer in DeForest.
And in our last 30 seconds or so, just on gifts, you know, I give state park stickers to several people.
That's an awesome gift. So entry to State Park Pass. We often talk about things related to feeding birds or watching birds. So whether that's a gift certificate to a local nature center, nature store that sells bird seed, that could go, that's awfully helpful. And then I always like to try to promote with children. So whether that's birthday or Christmas Christmas gifts for kids, how can we engage them in nature? So butterfly nets, terrariums. There's lots of good books on getting, you know, doing scavenger hunts or things that you can do outside, creating a natural playground in your backyard, building forts, all of those things.
I think also just handwriting a certificate that you're going to spend time together
there
outside.
Yeah.
All good ideas. David, Jamie, thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to seeing you in a couple of months.
February.
All right. Jamie Nack and David Drake. Jamie, a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, David, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. I'd like to thank them and thank you for listening. And remind you, coming up, we're going to take a look at snowy owls in our state. I'm Larry Mueller. A little music to get us started here as we talk about snowy owls in our state. Beautiful birds. They're a sight to behold. And really happy to have with us today by phone, Ryan Beatty, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. For more than 10 years, Ryan's been keeping track of the number of snowy owl sightings statewide. And he's with us to share what he's learned about these majestic-looking birds of prey. And that song, by the way, was by Wagon Band. And, of course, we want to hear from you. Questions about snowy owls in our state? Did you see one? What was the interaction like? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Ryan Beatty, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Larry. It's great to be here.
Well, listen, since at least 2013, you've been keeping track of snowy owl sightings. Why did you start doing this?
Yeah, that's a good question, Larry. I didn't know I was starting it when I started it, which is how often these things go. For two reasons. One was kind of the science behind it and just trying to better understand a species that we really don't know that much about, despite all the allure that they come with. But more importantly, I was getting a lot of questions. A lot of folks had very high interest in the species. It's an extremely popular, charismatic bird that the public loves. And as such, and being one of the state's ornithologists, I needed to kind of know what was going on. So I started keeping track. And the two things have come together quite nicely to a nice little data set that has kind of given us the pattern of snowy owl movements into the state over the last decade or so.
So what does your database tell us about the migration of snowy owls?
Well, for this year, we're seeing a few birds, which is more than we can say of the last couple of years, thankfully. So there's been a lot of buzz lately in the birding community because there's been more owls moving into the state over the last few weeks than they can remember over the last few years. And those hunches are correct. This time last year, we had only two snowy owls reported in the whole state. And as of yesterday, we've had upwards of 30 reported in the state this year. So quite the increase, which is good. It's not a big year for snowy owls. We've had some eruptions in past years, and we can talk about these periodic influxes of owls known as eruptions. But the last big eruption we had was in 2021, and then we had an even bigger eruption back in 2017. So the numbers we're seeing now don't quite rival those eruption years, but they're better than the last few.
And we should talk a little bit about their habits to begin with. And you know, I had often heard that it was a low number of lemmings, for example, that forced the birds down. But now the new research is showing that, in fact, the opposite's probably true.
Yeah, and my money says it could be a little bit of both, to be honest. But most likely, or at least in most cases, when we see a lot of snowy owls here in Wisconsin, it's because the lemming numbers were very high the previous summer in the Arctic. And so what does a little rodent in the Arctic have to do with snowy owl numbers in Wisconsin? Well, when there are more lemmings in the Arctic, the snowy owls make lots of babies. They do really well in terms of nesting success. They might produce 5, 6, 7 or more young owls, and then those young owls leave the nest and they disperse across the landscape and they move south, and that brings lots of owls down here to Wisconsin. In years when those lemming numbers are low, the owls may not have very good breeding success. There's not a lot to feed the baby, so maybe only one of them survives, or in some cases, they're such good gauges of the lemming population, they may not even nest in those years when the lemming numbers are low, in which case you have no young owls moving south, and just a few adults that maybe trickle down in, and thus numbers are lower. So really, it's how many lemmings there are in the summer, in turn producing how many baby owls are out there that might move into Wisconsin that year.
Eruptions. I like that term, eruptions, by the way.
Yes, and just to be clear, it's not an eruption like a volcano. It's an eruption.
I-R-R.
And it applies to more than just snowy owls. It applies to other bird species as well that make kind of, like I said, periodic influxes. So they might not have a regular migration into an area, or if they do, it's in small numbers in a non-eruption year. They might have a big pulse or movement based on food availability, or with some species, maybe weather helps drive it. And that would cause eruptive movements into a given area in a given year.
And, of course, they're not dining on lemmings here in Wisconsin.
No, but we have plenty of rodents that do mimic a lemming. And they don't just eat lemmings in the Arctic either. They'll eat birds like ptarmigan, which is a grouse-like bird of the Arctic. They'll eat a lot of waterfowl in there as well. It's really that the nesting success is heavily driven by those lemmings. But the adult birds, and especially in migration, all the birds during the winter as well, they get a really varied diet. They will eat small mice and voles and shrews and all those little rodents, but they'll eat a lot of other things. Rabbits are a favorite. Pigeons, which, as you can imagine, is not too unlike a ptarmigan of the north. Weasels, muskrats. And surprisingly, to a lot of folks, they eat a lot of waterfowl and water birds. So things like gulls and ducks and even geese.
So what would you call it? They'll take what they find.
They're very opportunistic.
That's the word I was thinking.
They're very opportunistic, and that allows them to occupy a number of different habitats. So, I mean, you might see them in these really wild, open landscapes that resemble the tundra, and maybe they're hunting primarily, you know, rabbits and small rodents like voles. But then you see them a lot in harbors and along the lake shores, not only because the waterfront tends to funnel them geographically when they're migrating, but also because they can find plenty of food there. They might find a lot of waterfowl, some gulls, maybe even some rodents in the rocks in the harbors. There's even a very famous picture of one carrying a mink.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, they're such a fascinating bird, you know, and they're different from other owls. I mean, they're more likely to be hunting in the daytime than the night.
And I think that's probably the single factor that makes them as appealing as they are. I mean, there's a number of different reasons, but I think the fact that they can be diurnal or seen during the day is a big contributing factor because people can see them and connect with them. So in general, people love owls. I think there's a certain intrigue to owls. There's this mysterious, you know, quality to them, especially at night. But you don't often get to see them. So when you can go out and see an owl during the day, it's really, really exciting. And then I think for snowy owls, when you add to it, you know, obviously they're very beautiful to look at, bright white plumage, these brilliant yellow eyes. They have these huge, massive feathered feet. You know, obviously easy to look at as well. But for some of us, including me, Larry, like I think it's really cool that they come all the way from these Arctic islands at the far northern end of Canada, almost to the North Pole, and to be connected to that place through a bird, you know, during the winter months is really kind of cool. And they're not that common. So they move unpredictably. There's no guarantee of seeing one. And so if you do find one, you're not going to necessarily take it for granted. So I think you add all those factors together, and it makes for kind of a perfect storm of charisma.
Speaking of storm, Project Snowstorm?
Yeah, so Project Snowstorm is an endeavor that brewed up out of one of these eruptions back in 2013, which was one of the biggest documented eruptions in the eastern United States in almost a century. And it included Wisconsin, where we had 300-plus owls that showed up here. But it's a cooperative or a collaboration and initiative, if you will, of researchers and conservationists looking to learn more about the species. And it's done a lot of fabulous work. It has a lot of great people. Some of you may be familiar with Scott Weidensahl, who's a very prominent author of a variety of great bird books. But he's also a fantastic researcher as well. And he's one of the leaders of the Project Snowstorm. And for the most part, they're studying winter ecology and tracking movements. They're putting devices on the birds, seeing how they move around, studying habitats, behavior near airports. But they're also getting data from the Arctic breeding grounds as well in a way we've never had before. So one of the reasons this species is so poorly known is because they're breeding way north above the Arctic Circle, where there's very few people. And as such, we know very little about the birds during that time. Project Snowstorm's starting to kind of crack into that a bit.
Ryan Brady, our guest today. Ryan Brady is a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. It's great to have him with us as we talk snowy owls, and inviting you to join in as well. Questions about snowy owls, or maybe an experience to share? Have you seen one or photographed it? Love to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Ryan Brady, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR, and he has studied and looked at and been collecting sightings of snowy owls in our state since 2013. And get some interesting information to learn about these owls as we move along today. Again, join in 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. And by the way, have you personally observed snowy owls in our state, Ryan?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I have been fortunate to see probably hundreds, to be honest. I live in the Ashland area on the south shore of Lake Superior. That's one of the best places in the state to find snowy owls, especially during the eruptive years. I've been fortunate to see, I think, three so far this year. And I can remember one year where I probably saw over 50, Larry.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty fortunate to live in a place where they're kind of plentiful here. And, you know, even though we get varying numbers every year, Wisconsin gets some snowy owls every year. So no matter what, there's a chance to see one.
Chris in Weston has a question for you. Hi, Chris.
Hey there. Thanks for taking the call. I was wondering about the snowy owls and how either they're impacted by other species of owls or how they may impact other species of owls like barred owls and such.
Yeah, good question. In general, there's kind of niches, if you will, or the way they fit into the environment. So they're mostly going to be in the more open areas, snowy owls, and as such, something like a barred owl is more of a forest species, so there won't be as much direct competition. Snowy owls will occupy, you know, maybe the same fields that, say, short-eared owls are in, and short-eared, if you've gone out and watched those at dusk, will hunt over an open field, just as it's getting dark, looking for small rodents. If there's snowy owls around, there can definitely be some interaction where the snowy owl kind of kicks those out because it's the dominant bird. But if there's enough rodents around, they might not get too territorial either. The other big one that comes into play would be in a kind of a semi-developed area where snowy owls sometimes set up, and you have some great horned owls around. Now, those are two of our largest owls. And as such, that'd be a good battle to witness. Unfortunately, I never have. But I imagine there's some tussles that take place in the darkness of night. And great horns are very fierce, so they could probably hold their own as residents. I would think they could hold their own on their resident territory here and kind of kick the visitor along. With that said, female snowy owls are considerably larger than males and will more easily usurp a territory than a male.
So how, in terms of, if you had a female snowy sitting next to a great horned, you'd certainly know the difference because of the coloration, but in terms of the size, how much different are they in size?
Not a lot different in, say, the height of the bird or even wingspan, really. Maybe the snowy's got a little bit of an edge. And then in terms of how much they weigh, a snowy on average is maybe a pound heavier. So they're pretty close, but obviously the great horns tend to be much darker plumaged overall, especially in the facial area.
Yeah. Bev in Rhinelander, we'll go to you. Hi, Bev.
Hi. I just wanted to say I was fortunate enough to see and photograph a snowy owl in Rhinelander last winter, and I was very excited about it. But when I hear there are only two in the whole state, I realize how lucky I was.
Bev, thanks for calling. But there's probably more.
Yeah, so I do. I think I remember that bird. There was, just to be clear, there were only two as of this date. So by the end of the winter last year, we had documented about 20 different owls. But still, to find one of those 20, especially in a Northwoods site like Rhinelander, is really, really excellent. Yeah, and my count, as you point out, Larry, I mean, it's an index, if you will. It's certainly not a final number. We have other sources of this data as well, to some extent, like eBird, which is an online platform for reporting bird observations. But certainly there are more owls on the landscape than get counted. With that said, with social media now and a big white bird like that and how excited people get about them, a lot of them show up on Facebook or Instagram or some other site. So the number that go undetected, I think, gets a little bit lower every year.
Well, in relation to that, Mary Beth in Appleton has something for us. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi. My son is a wildlife videographer, and he has just seen the white snowy owl, and his Instagram site is Nick Loves Wildlife. And he has videos of all the wildlife that we have, well, all that he's possibly seen in Wisconsin. So he's traveled all around Wisconsin and Minnesota, and actually in the Dominican Republic, and videoing different types of wildlife. So it's a great opportunity for someone to see the snowy owl and other wildlife in Wisconsin.
Nick Loves Wildlife. Thank you, Mary Beth. Appreciate it. Just thinking about that, I think they're some of the most photographed birds. I have, I think it's a 40 by 30 photo framed from Tom Mangelson. You may know of him. Well, he's a pretty famous wildlife photographer. And it is a snowy owl on a barn roof and a blue sky, and this roof, kind of a grayish kind of building, and that snowy owl perched on top of his absolutely beautiful photo, and a large one. Takes up a lot of space. And I also have a wood carving of a snowy owl as well, full size. And I love that as well. Do you have any? I'm sure you, Ryan Brady, you've probably taken many photos of snowies.
I do have a lot of photos, and I'll always take more because they're so photogenic. And every time I see one, the camera has to come out, regardless of maybe where it's sitting or how far away it is. And to that point, they're an extremely popular bird even among non-birders. So if you think about just casual, you know, onlookers who maybe don't have a great love of nature or the outdoors, they still pay attention to a snowy owl. And in the world of photography, a lot of folks, you know, their kind of doorway to bird photography is through snowy owls and other owls as well. And I think it just kind of speaks to how much people kind of love those birds.
Yeah. Mary Beth, thank you. Jim and Hayward, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about the migration. When snowy owls migrate, are they solitary migrators, or do they go in groups, or how does it happen?
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, they are solitary migrators. It is not impossible for a couple to stay somewhat in touch with each other and maybe end up in the same spot, even nearby. And whether those are siblings or, you know, mated pairs, I think is very unknown. But for the most part, they are migrating singly. The majority of them are migrating at night, at relatively low altitudes, and they can cover hundreds of miles in a night, and they can fly over big water bodies, whether it's Hudson Bay or Lake Superior or Lake Michigan. They're pretty proficient at flight.
Yeah, for sure. That's really interesting. Jim, thank you for calling. Albert in Northern Greene County. Hi, Albert.
Hello, Larry.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to report a sighting of a snowy owl. It was quite a few years ago. It was during the Harry Potter craze. I have a stand of woods outside my house, and from my deck, I see all kinds of birds out there, all kinds of woodpeckers. And there are owls. I've heard the barred owl. I don't see them, but I hear them. And one morning I went out on my deck, and there was a snowy owl perched on the tree, and he was looking over my land. And I was hoping he would stay, because we have plenty of rodents for him, I'll tell you that.
Well, it's a good story, and you mentioned hearing the barred owl. Jeff Robbins, our technical director today, has the song of the snowy owl. Let's listen to that so you can hear it. There we go. Have you heard that song, Ryan?
I have not, and that would be one they would give on the breeding territory, most likely, and I'll point out that's not much of a song. I think we can all agree about that.
Yeah.
but it's a low, raspy hoot that they would give on the breeding grounds. On the wintering grounds, they're generally silent, much more so than other owls. Occasionally, when they're in a territorial dispute, or as, you know, maybe March, April comes and the hormones start getting going a little bit, you might hear them make some whistles or some barks or some other little short noises. But they certainly don't have the traditional kind of patterned hoot that a lot of our other owls have.
Bill in Oregon saw one night on Highway 22 near Alcona Falls. From a distance, it looked like a big white garbage bag on the side of the road. Then it started flapping its wings as it got closer. As he got closer, he assumed it was eating roadkill. Will snowy owls eat carrion?
They will if they need to, especially in harder times. I mean, it could have been that it killed something on the side of the road. That is one of the more popular places for them to hunt, in these roadside ditches, which unfortunately also leads to one of their leading causes of mortality here in the winter, which is collisions with vehicles. So it's possible it was eating some carrion. It could have caught its own as well.
Yeah. Marge Gibson, who is one of the rehabbers, one of the most famous rehabbers I think we have in our state, has had to treat some of the injured ones, and some have even been brought in dead.
Yeah, so in some years, when these birds get here, they might be a little bit emaciated. You know, they've flown almost 2,000 miles. Maybe they had this long crossing over the boreal forest or a long crossing over one of the lakes. Maybe it's a young bird that doesn't have as good of hunting skills and thus wasn't able to put on the appropriate fat and resources it needed to make the journey, and they end up in rehabilitation. With that said, many of healthy ones are struck by vehicles as well, and there might be some electrocution issues as well, or maybe collisions with other infrastructure, not just you know, cars going along. But one of the biggest issues, Larry, is secondary poisoning from rodenticides.
Oh.
So if anyone out there is using kind of these mouse or rodent poisons, you want to be really careful, and I would strongly discourage it, because it doesn't act right away, and then the rodent goes away with the poison, and then the owl catches the rodent, and that can cause the death of the owl.
Oh, man. Well, they're a wonder to see, and Ryan, I want to thank you so much for taking a few minutes to be with us today to talk about them. I hope we can do this again. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was great to be here.
Ryan Brady is a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR and obviously knows a whole lot about snowy owls. Love to see those birds. And love to have you listening in, and I want to thank you so much for listening in. This and all of our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Our consumer protection folks are with us tomorrow on the show, but for now, stay with us. There's lots more in store right through the afternoon on WPR News.